And honestly, like the point where Neil and Hannah go off on their own and like have a chat, I actually very much enjoyed. What I didn't enjoy necessarily, and I was trying to narrow down what I didn't like about this. I think I don't like that it's the adults who are pushing the kids to be the child soldiers, and we're still supposed to view Strix as like vaguely a good guy-ish, like not necessarily straight evil, because that's really the only way I can view that character that's doing that is like evil, like a
Right.
bad character. And it may turn out that they are, but I think the reason why I thought this is like if you look at kids' stories, kids being subjected to violence is a staple of children's stories, right?
Yeah.
The Hunger Games, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, Aragon, the original Star Wars, right? Anything you look at. However, the responsible adults in those stories are always trying to keep the kids away from that. They're trying to prevent that from happening to the kids. They're not pushing the kids into it. And if they are pushing the kids into it, then they're viewed as evil characters, like bad characters. And I think the disconnect for me was that like I am so used to the characters who push children into violent situations being viewed as the bad guys, but they're portraying Strix as like a neutral, potentially friendly, like vaguely menacing, but not openly evil character. And for me, it was like, oh, if this dude's a dictator, then like, oh yeah, I understand what's going on. But like Hannah loves him and is like, you know, he seems to be like a genial guy. And like that was the weird disconnect. I think that's what tweaked something in my brain where I was like, oh, I feel like I'm supposed to hate this guy and think he's evil, but they're not playing it that way.
So I actually really liked Strix as a character. Like, I don't think I would like him as a person because he is absolutely evil. But like to borrow like some Dungeons and Dragons terms here, I feel like he falls into the vein of a lawful evil character in that he is willing to do horrible things to achieve his goals, but he operates under like the guidance of a certain code of behavior and honor that can make it a little confusing for somebody who's used to more clear portrayals where the villain will just do whatever they want to break their word. And that's not the kind of villain that he is. He is absolutely a military dictator. He will do unspeakable things to achieve his goals, but he will also keep his word. And, you know, he will, you know, respect his subordinates and, you know, even if they're children, he's following what he said, right? He's like, I treat them as adults, and so when they do well, I reward them. And it's like, he is a confusing figure, I think, for a lot of people, because you don't get a lot of villains who are written to play that way. He's kind of like, to some extent, he falls close to an anti-villain. I could compare him to Dexter, except that Dexter is very hands-on, whereas Strix is a leader type character, right? So, you know, Dexter is unapologetically an evil character in that show, right? He is a serial killer. I don't think we can say that a world in which we just are like fine with serial killers running around is a good world. But we're sympathetic to him because he follows a code and he only kills people that we think of as being bad, you know, worse than him, for example. And so it makes him sympathetic, but then you're also like, crap, I'm being sympathetic to a serial killer. What does this say about me? And I think that's the problem that Strix has as a character, is you're like, oh, I'm sort of feeling a little bit sympathetic toward a military dictator with child soldiers, including his own child. What does that say about me? I shouldn't like him, but I don't hate him. Don't know how to feel about it. So yeah, he's a little bit complicated, you know?
My question is, could they not have, and I'll say this and then we'll move on. Did they need to have the whole we treat children like adults thing? Could they not have accomplished the same goal of him being like, Hannah, I've told you not to run off like that. Like you're only supposed to stay within our borders on your patrols, right? Like air quotes patrols. Like, could they not have and her been like, yeah, but father, I found the Eopies, the Hatton have them. And then have him be like, well, you know, these kids will be an excellent addition to our labor force or something like that. And then you still get the same kind of like, oh crap, like he's gonna indoctrinate them into the troik. He's not gonna just like let them leave, but at the same time, he's not gonna like turn them into soldiers and like let them free. Because like, let's be honest here, like there's a reason that children are like not super effective soldiers, is because they're basically just cannon fodder with guns, right? Like, that's what children are, because they're physically not strong enough to like be really effective soldiers.
Right.
So they kind of just turn into cannon fodder with guns. And unfortunately in real life, like that's how child soldiers are used. Like, and so to me, it was like, I feel like they could have accomplished the same goal of portraying him as this, like, oh, he's like a nice guy. He runs a society, but also you're probably like the equivalent of slave labor now for this guy. And you're going to get trained up. And I feel like they could have accomplished that without him being like, we treat our children as adults, which that line, I think for me was the thing that I was like, I don't know, this weird disconnect here. And it may be like, there's two ways that this goes here, right? One, they never meet this guy again and it's irrelevant and it has no bearing on the story at all. And I forget about it next episode.
Right.
Two, this guy comes back and actually is like kind of a villain. And then it's like, oh, okay, well it makes sense now why he would be using child soldiers. Either one of those is, I think, going to be fine with me long term, but it just feels like to me we could have avoided the whole situation by having him just be like, hey, no, I told you not to leave, you know, the thing, and her being like, oh, but I found the Eopis and I found these kids, and then they move on with it. And it's like, oh, okay. Like now it kind of makes sense. Like her and her buddy are supposed to like patrol the school, right? Because that's, you give kids something to do. But then they snuck out and, you know, found these other kids and brought them back. Like, to me, it felt like we would have ended up at the exact same place without the weird child soldier nonsense type thing. But that's just me.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of the point of this story is that the larger galaxy is a bad place and it's a dangerous place and it's not a place that these kids should be wandering around in. And I think if Strix was portrayed as being less malevolent, that message would not have been driven home. And, you know, I mean, I think that's fine if that's the story they wanted to tell. But what we've seen kind of at every turn for these kids is that everywhere they go, they should under no circumstances be there.
Right.
There's no safe haven whatsoever. Even the people who are trying to help them, it's real questionable whether or not they're actually interested in helping them. Right. Yeah. You know, we see that on the pirate world, that woman was saying that she was going to help them escape. But was she? Like, it's really unclear. You know, or was she going to like sell them as slaves or something? Like, that's a very real possibility in the Star Wars galaxy. Like,
so you're saying the moral of this story from the point of the writers is never leave home. Everything is dangerous.
Pretty much.
Stay as close to home as possible and don't go on adventures. It's terrible for you.
Yeah. Like, I think it's very much like adventures are not as fun as they're made out to be. Like, that's really the message I am taking so far.
Unless you're Wim and you just have like no concept of what danger is, in which case they're tons of fun.
I think he's getting there.
Yeah,
he's the slow one on that note, but he's getting there.
So he does. Strix does ask them, you know, he says, you know, we treat our children as adults. So rise up. What is it that you're doing here? And they're like, oh, well, we're looking for directions home. And he's like, or I think Fern says to our homeworld of Ad-Atten, have you heard of it? And he's like, no, we don't really concern ourselves in dealings with offworlders other than trading our hides for munitions.
Right.
Which does at least explain how they've gotten these like weapons and stuff like that. So Wim says, do you have any access to ancient maps or star charts? And before he can respond, Haina's like, well, what about all the stuff that's in the Fallen Sanctum? Which, of course, anytime you name something the Fallen Sanctum is going to pique anyone's interest.
Right.
It's no different for the children. And he's like, Haina, no. We don't talk about that place. Like, it's too dangerous of a journey. You know, we don't want to send people there. You know, I kind of get the feeling that it's really not that dangerous of a journey, but he just wants to be able to utilize these children as like additional forces, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they would be, I mean, you can't possibly look at Wim and Neil and be like, yeah, these are going to be great child soldiers. Like, they're going to be fantastic.
I mean, I think, you know, for his purposes of using them to draw out the enemy, they're going to serve that purpose really well. But like I said, Strix is unapologetically a villain. Right. He's just a lawful villain.
Yeah. I felt like I could have used like a light amount more mustache twirling from him. Cause like he does this weird thing where he's like acting kind of friendly to the kids, but also like going to use them as cannon fodder.
I mean, I think he wants them to do what he wants to do. So he's not going to be overtly malevolent.
Yeah.
But anyways. Haina explains the Fallen Sanctum has carvings and coordinates for other planets. Maybe one of those is their home. And Fern's like, well, can you take us there? you know, and Strix is like, well, no, it's too dangerous, too far away. You won't survive the journey. You'll have to get stronger first. So he says, you know, if you train with my warriors and prove yourselves worthy, then I'll take you to the Fallen Sanctum. And I think this is a good deal for him because he's like, they're not going to survive. I won't have to do anything. And, you know, I'll achieve my objective of punishing the Hatton and getting my Opies back. And worst comes to worst, they do survive. The Fallen Sanctum actually isn't that far. And I really haven't had to pay that high a price.
Yeah.
And, you know, these kids are clearly too incompetent for me to want to keep them around long term. Right. Like that's how I see this playing out for Strix. Is he's like, this is a one-time benefit for me for almost no cost. And I don't have to pressure them. They're going to do what I want them to do because they're willing to. I think he's a very clever person. Right? I don't think you become the military dictator on a planet like this without being cunning as all heck. So,
yeah, I mean, I had like,
he's a great villain.
I had a weird dichotomy. Maybe it was just because it was like, we don't actually see them train, but I was like, how much training are these kids actually going to get in like the 35 minutes they've got before they like go out on this next thing? And I understand that's like, oh, well, we just need to teach them how to use the blasters effectively. Like that's basically all it is like, but like they don't get uniforms. They don't get like training felt to me like a misnomer. And it was more like, hey, we're going to teach you how to shoot this thing with a blaster. And then we're going to send you out literally wearing your brightly colored like human clothes or Atten clothes to basically be bait.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you can shoot a blaster, at least you can shoot a blaster. And so training, I was like, oh, yeah, training with the warriors is really more of like, hey, go shoot some cans and be done with it. But they don't need to really focus hard on that, right? There's a nice little bit of competition between, like, Wim and Fern that goes on. But for the most part, this is where Neil, like, rises up, and we get a bunch of really solid, good Neil time out of this.
So we do have a brief aside here as we catch up with Jod at SM-33. And Jod is kind of trying to prompt 33 to talk about Atten, kind of quizzing him, kind of trying to work his way around whatever the block is in SM-33's memory. And SM-33 does comment, says a few things about Ad Akron and it being dangerous and there being
warriors
on the planet. And the fog sort of clears a little bit and they find themselves, as they're standing outside the ship, surrounded by Hatton warriors who immediately ask what flag they fly. And Jod's just like, just shoot me.
Yeah.
He's like, well, I can't deal with this. Then we go back to the kids and their shooting practice. And Fern and Wim and KB are all, you know, seem to be kind of having a good time competing and playing with the guns, which I think, as a couple of people in Discord pointed out, there's definitely some dark vibes here, right? Like, they're using live fire weapons, essentially unsupervised.
Yep.
It is definitely questionable.
That's what I'm saying. Like, at least in Star Trek, they have, like, phasers that are set to stun. Or usually even in Star Wars, it's like, like they set the guns to stun.
Right.
And it's like, okay, well, and this is clearly not that. Like, they're shooting real guns, you know, they're arguing. This is the same thing where I felt a little bit weird when Jod put them in the turrets and they were shooting at the X-Wings. And I was like, man, I really don't want one of these kids to, like, shoot down an X-Wing and kill, like, someone.
Right.
Like, this is kind of weirdly, you know, dark. And I felt the same way here. You know, Neil, of course, being the voice of reason, hangs back and just, like, sets the gun down. And Hannah's like, you know, your friends are hopeless. And Neil's like, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
He's like, I would expect that. And Hannah's like, do you not want to shoot the guns? And he's like, no, not really. And Hannah's like, oh, that's very wise. We have much bigger weapons. Let me show you.
Yeah, I think she says, these weapons are weak.
Yeah. Like, let me show you something much bigger, that much more powerful than a blaster.
Yeah.
So they take him up to a turbo lift to the top of the school where there's basically a tent village where all the Troiks live. They get, you know, their daily rations. And Neil's kind of like, why are you guys fighting? And this was actually, from like this point on, I kind of enjoy the episode a lot more. But Neil kind of says, why are you guys fighting? And it becomes clear that, like, they're just fighting because they're fighting, right? Hannah says, well, last week the Hatton stole a herd of our Eopies, so this week we're going to steal them back and burn one of their granaries.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, he's asking, like, why are you guys fighting from the beginning? And, like, clearly that knowledge has been lost. Like, they're just fighting because they've always been fighting. And they even refer to each other as, like, clans. And, like, I get the feeling this is, like, a Hatfield and McCoy type situation, right? where these two clans are just fighting because they've always been fighting. And, you know, Neil is like, well, you know, you don't have to fight. Like, you could just kind of like make peace with them and not do that. And she kind of just like blows it off and is like, you know, the old generation says the new generations are weaker and weaker. But when my dad dies, I'm going to be the one who destroys the Hutans.
Yeah.
And Neil's just like, oh, okay, I guess.
So, yeah, they get their rations. There is a nice moment where Neil sees a couple of younger children who look pretty hungry. And
who are clearly not being treated as adults, I get the feeling like, right? Like, they seem to be being treated like kids, so clearly it's not all kids that are treated like adults.
Yes, maybe they failed their scouting mission. Anyways, Neil shares his food with them, which, you know, Haina takes note of. And she says she has something to show him, and she unlocks this crank and cranks this door open that reveals a massive, if rather old, turbo laser cannon that rises up on a circular platform. And she explains that this is a weapon from the old days, which they use for protection. And it's like the greatest source of Detroit's strength. And what you mentioned, that is, you know, something I also thought about as I was watching this. Very interesting. It's pretty clear that they didn't install this turbo laser cannon here. They don't have that kind of technology that we have seen. It seems unlikely they were able to trade hides to get a massive turbo laser cannon installed on the roof. So this presumably has always been here, which would suggest that the school on Ad-Aten also has a turbo laser cannon installed on the roof, which just raises all sorts of questions.
Is this not the world's biggest or the galaxy's biggest Chekhov gun, basically?
Yeah.
Like, you know, you got a turbo laser in your school, guys. Like, we're going to have to see that at some point in time.
It does feel like they're going to get to Ad-Aten, and that turbo laser is going to activate and try to shoot them down, possibly for the second time.
I think that I really enjoy this. Also, I forgot to mention this. On the subject of Strix being a villain, he talks about trading hides for weapons, and then he like weirdly touches Neil's like face, and I was like, oh my god, is he gonna like use Neil as a hide? It's like that what he's thinking about with this, but I don't know why I caught that just when he was saying it, but it was because it was like right after him saying that they trade hides for munitions, and then he like touches Neil's face, and I was like, Neil has a hide, like no, don't use him for that. But obviously, oof, that does not come to pass, because that would be even darker than dark. But this is what happens when you introduce a general who uses child soldiers. You know, you feel like nothing is beneath him. But so you
getting
know, Haina,
a little Jonathan Swift modest proposal there. Let's not go down that road.
So Neil tells Haina that this endless fighting is pointless, and he's like, look, that building over there, you know, on my planet, that's where my mom works, and she's an analyst, and I'm going to be an analyst too when I graduate. You know, the supervisor will give me a job. And Haina's like, is there not conflict on your world? And he's like, no, not really. You know, we have a game called Slapball. And he's like, I'm the best. And she's like, wow, you must be a really weak clan. And he's like, yeah, probably.
The way he's like slaps his hands.
Yeah, it was very funny. It's good. It's good character acting.
It is. It really is. So they're kind of, you know, sitting there on the ledge of the building, sort of talking about their lives. And, you know, Hane is like, you know, strength is what defines us. You know, conflict is kind of constant here. You know, Neil, I think, asks, you know, he asks the right questions here. He's like, how does this all end? You know, will it ever end? Haina doesn't really have an answer for that. You know, like, of course, they think that at some point they'll conquer the planet. But it's like, does she really believe that'll happen? It seems like she doesn't. And he explains that, you know, like, he solves conflicts by apologizing. And he talks about, you know, his brother stole his protractor and he chased him around until his brother jumped on his head and he fell on the credenza and sprained his trunk. And he kind of feels like he lost that fight, even though he's much bigger than his brother. And there's just something so endearing about this story that even Haina is moved by it. You know, and it's clear, of course, she's never met anyone like Neil, right? Like, somebody like Neil would not survive on Ad-Akron. But you can't help but like Neil. I think that's true, even if you are child soldier on a war-torn post-apocalyptic at Akron. So meanwhile, back at the training grounds, you know, KB is sort of showing off. You know, Wim compliments her and tries to high-five her, which I guess she doesn't do. And then Neil and Haina come back. And Wim wants to show off, so he gets, like, essentially a shotgun blaster out and fires it, which sends him flying back, like, 6 feet, which is kind of funny, but also, like, oh, he's going to be taking this into battle? That's going to go well.
Yeah.
So General Strix, though, walks up and compliments Wim's fighting spirit, which for me just reinforces the cunning villain persona, that he's just trying to build them up so that they'll go willingly into battle and die as cannon fodder, and he won't have to make good on the deal that he made. So he says he's giving Captain Fern and her crew the honor of leading them into battle against the Hatton. Neil is the only one with a truly appropriate response here. He's just like, what? Fern tries to weasel out of doing this, but Strix insists, dramatically banging his stick on the ground to interrupt her and make clear that they've made a deal and he intends for that deal to be honored one way or another. Again, he's a villain. That's how you're supposed to feel about him. So we sort of come to a climax of the episode here. The children are kind of being prodded into the lead. They are talking about running away, and it's like they think that they're talking just to each other, but there's a Troik soldier like right there, and he's like, that's gonna get you shot for desertion.
Yep.
It's like, oh, you're not being nearly as secretive as you think you are. And then I think they do say something about trying to run away as they're actually being prodded out ahead. And like every Troik soldier just points their gun at the kids and they're sort of like, oh, OK, I guess we are doing this now. This is
not really so much of an honor,
yeah,
as he would make it seem.
It's suddenly a lot less fun, right? Nobody is smiling anymore. Nobody's joking. This is suddenly deadly serious. Neil, of course, is freaking out and I think, again, has the only truly believable reaction here where he is freezing up and there's some sort of, you know, semi like acknowledged threat that they're just going to shoot Neil if he doesn't start walking. And I don't think that they're like completely explicit about it. But again, all the guns are pointed. The threat has been made. Haina says, I'll go with them. Strix sort of objects. It doesn't seem like he's necessarily objecting because she's his daughter so much as like that she has no obligation to do this. And they do. But she insists. And, you know, Neil's like, you don't have to do that. But she's like, it's easier with a friend. And that's, you know, Neil kind of acknowledges that. And I think this is a moment where we see that Neil's had a real effect on Haina. And has maybe started to show her that there could be a better way of doing things than the way that they've always done it. And they kind of resolve this moment. They walk forward into the fog and they're all terrified. And there's kind of a moment where we're all left wondering, like, is there about to be a battle? Like, what's going to happen here? I think it's a great moment. It's played really well. I felt the tension, like, even though I know that the kids are all going to survive. It's a really tense moment. But then they hear animal noises coming from ahead of them in the fog. And who should pop out but Ja Nana Wood, holding a staff in his hand, accompanied by SM-33, and very shortly, a whole herd of Eopies. And God reveals that he recovered the Opies from the Hattons and is returning them to them. And, you know, Strix, of course, is appreciative and being the honorable fellow that he is, says, well, I will give you any reward that you like. And thanks for, you know, what you've done for us. And Jod says, well, I want, you know, there's kind of a bit of waffling, but he's like, I want the kids, of course. You know, I want these four. Strix is like, are you sure? Like, they're not really worth much. I'll give you some of my best hides instead. You know, he's like, I think he feels a legitimate obligation to reward Jod. And again, he's a cunning evil villain, because you have to let your people see you being generous when something good happens so that they will continue to serve you willingly. You know, it's like you want to be feared and loved.
I feel like you feel about Strix the way I felt about Cam in the previous episode.
Maybe
like,
so. I think he's a great villain.
Strix has thrown me off. I mean, I think he's acted well. I think he's portrayed well. By this like weird line on like being benevolent, but also using child soldiers is like a weird thing for me to straddle. Because usually if you have a character that's gray, they're like a little black and a little white. Yeah. And they're like right next to each other. This is like a little white and like way all the way over on the other side of being bad. That I'm finding like the middle between those two is like, he's honorable. He keeps his word. And also he uses child soldiers. And like the middle point between those two is like still way into evil, but they're not playing him like that. They're playing him like, you know, he's like, a pretty good father. And like all this stuff, I'm like, this is very odd. I mean, he doesn't want Haina to go sacrifice herself with the rest of the children, even though he eventually lets her. He doesn't put up that much of a fight, I guess.
I think, we don't know how many kids Strix has had that haven't made it.
That's true.
Like,
Haina is the sixth of her kind, basically.
Right, there's no telling if she's the eldest by survival or by birth. It's really unclear. But
yeah.
Anyways.
Thankfully, all this part's basically done, right? Yes. So like the whole part of the thing at this point in time, like this is the final part of it. You know, Hannah's like, look, you know, they proved their bravery. They led the patrol just because they didn't die. We actually should take them to the Fallen Sanctum now. And so he's like, all right, fine. You know, she volunteers to take them basically. And he approves it. So Jod recounts, you know, he takes his time to recount his encounter with the Hatans, and he tells them that, he says, you younglings have joined up with our sworn enemy, the Troiks. And he's like, you know, it turns out they hate the Troiks, but you know what they love is making a deal.
Yeah.
And so I was able to actually buy back the Eopies with some credits that you guys had. And Wim's like, did you steal my money? And he's like, yeah, but I mean, I did it to save your lives, obviously.
Right. Yeah. He definitely wasn't going to steal that money anyways. So
part of me wondered if he actually did, like, I don't think this is what happened, because I think you're right that like generally if he can, like he'll just make a deal and he'll avoid violence. But part of me wonders if him and SM-33 just killed all the Hatans and stole the Eopies and he just like didn't want to say that. They're going to get back to the ship and there's just going to be like Hatan soldier bodies like all over the place. But, you know, I don't think that's actually what he did. But part of me thought about that in the episode. I was like, I wonder if he actually bought them back or if he kept the credits for himself and just fought everyone.
I do feel like it's possible that SM-33 threw a couple of the Hatan warriors like 30 feet through the air, and then the rest of them were real excited about making a deal.
He encouraged them to come to an agreement.
What do they call it? Aggressive diplomacy?
Yeah, aggressive negotiations.
Yeah, aggressive negotiations. Thank you.
So, you know, Haina points out the way to the Fallen Sanctum, which Neil correctly remarks that, like, hey, that's the supervisor's tower back home. You know, SM-33, I think he says that the supervisor's tower on Ad-Ad, and SM-33 is like, I can't remember no Ad-Ad.
Yeah.
Because, of course, he's got to say that. They're all like, we know, like, stop saying that. And Haina's like, all right, this is where I leave you. You know, I got to return to my father. And he says, you know, you could just come with us. Like, you don't have to fight all the time. You could live on Ad-Ad. And she's like, no, this is where I belong. But I will remember your ways when I become the leader of our clan. And she appreciates that she learned kindness from him. And I think she, like, gives him a kiss on the trunk or something like that.
It does, yeah.
Which, you know, Neil's forgotten all about whatever the girl's name was that I've also forgotten about, the green girl from his class that he was previously in love with. But
he has, yes. And then Haina runs off and jumps up onto a rock and does a flip off of it for absolutely no reason. And I love
it. Gotta look cool for Neil. Yeah. For the boy who has a crush on her.
It is kind of that, isn't it? Yeah, she is showing off for Neil. She knows he's watching. Anyways, they head into the Fallen Sanctum, aka the Ad Akron Supervisor's Tower. and KB hotwires the turbo lift, which luckily is still working. And they find themselves up top in a ruined chamber with stone pillars and not much else. They start kind of looking around for any sign of maps or coordinates, and SM-33's muttering about not remembering AT-ATN. And they find some carvings, I think on one of the pillars or walls. I think it's on one of the pillars.
It's on one of the pillars.
Hidden behind the dust. And Jod recognizes the letters as saying at A2. It almost sounded like he was saying at Achu to me, but I think it's at A2. And that there are, in fact, coordinates for the planet. And they discover a second set of coordinates, which lead to AT-ACRON, the planet that they're on, which Kim had given them. And they find coordinates for AT-ARISIA and AT-ARAVAN. And then Neil finds AT-ATN. But the coordinates have been blasted off the rock, just absolutely sheared away, like somebody took a blowtorch or a lightsaber to it. And Neil's like, who would do this? And SM-33 is like, I would. And they are obviously all kind of shocked by this, while we as the audience are the least shocked of anyone. But also, I was pretty delighted that, again, they're not messing around. They're not dragging it out. They're just getting right into it. SM-33 is like, I did it. Let's not beat around the bush, right? Let's just tell this part of the story and get into the meat of it. And I think Fern asks why. And 33 reveals that he was here years ago with his old captain. They want to know why he would destroy the coordinates to AT-ATN. He says, I can't say I remember no AT-ATN. Fern orders him to stop saying that. And, you know, KB's like, maybe we can fix him. But Jod's kind of decided that he's not fixable, that he's too busted. Fern is really frustrated, and we kind of have a nice moment here between Fern. And she's disheartened, right? Everything that they've tried to do to get home has failed. They've gone from the frying pan into the fire. And she feels like an absolute failure. She feels like it's all her fault. And she says something that I never would have thought I would hear Fern say. She says that she should have let Wim be captain. And then Wim says something that I never would have thought I would hear Wim say. He's like, no, we wouldn't have made it half this far if I was captain. You've been a great captain. And this is a really nice moment, because we do see that character growth that we had talked about hoping for out of these two. You know, we see Fern sort of recognizing that she can't talk her way out of every situation, that she is just a kid. And we see Wim recognizing that the world is not the same as the adventure books that he likes to read, and that, you know, it's tough, and that you have to be smart and careful, and you can't just run off and do random things for kicks all the time. And that's, you know, he sees Fern doing a good job, and he lets her know. And it's, I think it's kind of a great moment.
Yeah. The only thing I didn't like about this conversation, I liked the entirety of the conversation. It was nice seeing Fern, you know, break and like be kind of a kid for once.
Yeah.
Because she's put on this persona of not being a kid. And it was nice to see like the frustration actually get to her. You know, I saw some reviews on IMDb that were like, oh, this feels like too rapid of a departure from her character. And I was like, no, it feels entirely earned. It's been four episodes of her like hiding this persona on, or having this facade on, and having it finally crack, because they think they're there, and then it didn't work one more time. Like, everything they've tried doesn't work. Like, they're really no closer than they were initially. And I liked seeing that frustration hit. And I also like seeing Wim acknowledge that, like, I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I'm just out here goofing around. The thing that I didn't like is her, like, he says, like, don't worry, like, you're the captain, you'll figure something else out. And her taking that as like, you're telling me to figure something else out. I'm not a droid. I don't do what I'm told, which I felt was like a bit defensive from her. And they did it because they had to make her have the realization of like, a droid doing what I'm told. I felt like that portrayal could have been like a little softer on her part. It didn't feel like it warranted like that immediate snap to defensiveness. when Wim was like just being nice to her. But it's a pretty minor nitpick overall, and it's offset almost immediately by the fact that she realizes, like, oh wait, droids do what they're told.
I'll say, to me, it feels like really organic relationship development, because they have been like antagonistic toward each other the entire time so far. Like, they have not been getting along, and this is a nice moment, and it's kind of the first time Wim is being nice to her. But for her to then get defensive and to maybe misread his intentions totally feels in line for me. Like, this felt very believable, more believable than if they had just turned around and been friends after that. Right? Like, that's not how real relationships work. When you have a tough relationship with somebody, you can have those nice moments, and sometimes they work out, and sometimes they devolve into defensiveness because one of you misreads the other. And it's tough, and it's you know, obviously it's tough for adults, it's tough for kids, you know. But I felt like it was very realistic in a way that you almost never see in TV. Normally in a TV show or a movie, when people have this sort of like heart-to-heart moment, it's a turning point and suddenly all is forgiven. And that, to be honest, like, it's fine in a comedy where I don't really expect relationships to be realistic, but in a more dramatic show when that happens, I can't help but roll my eyes every time when they just like suddenly stop fighting. I'm like, that's not how people are. Like, that's people hold grudges, and it takes time to build those connections. So for me, again, incredible writing on a kid's show where I least expected it. Like, the depth of character for me is like really, really good. But I get where you're coming from. It does violate, I think, expectations in a way for her to be defensive. We should move on. It is a small moment. And we get to the real excitement of the episode right after this.
Well, this is probably my favorite scene of the episode. But, you know, KB is examining SM-33, but Fern walks up and asks SM-33 where at Atnez, and he repeats that he cannot remember such a planet. And she says, I bet he can, but he's been programmed to forget the location. And she's like, I use this trick all the time on my nanny droid. And so she says, as your captain, initiate memory override and retrieve all information related to At-Aten that is stored in your memory banks. And, you know, SM-33 like thinks about it for a bit, and you can hear his circuits whirring. And he's like, ah, I do remember At-Aten. I remember that the captain killed any of his crew who saw the coordinates to At-Aten, slaughtered them, he did. Then he ordered me to dispose of their remains and forget everything I knew about At-Aten. And Fern's like, oh, great, so you can take us there. And SM-33 is like, well, he also ordered me to kill anyone who was asking questions about At-Aten or was looking for the treasure. And Jon immediately is like, oh, shit. So he's like, Wim, give me the blaster. Give me the blaster now. And SM-33 says he told me to pull them, or tear them apart, limb from limb. And he starts chanting limb from limb in this super creepy, eerie so manner. Creepy. And he like starts doing his like limbs extend, and he gets bigger and he moves back. This reminds me a lot. I don't know if you remember the episode of Rebels where they get the assassin droid that is disguised as a protocol droid.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And when it activates, it like extends all of its arms out. And the voice changes. And that's what this reminded me of a lot, of these droids that are like, they have like a normal form, but when they go to their work form, they like extend out and become bigger. And this reminded me a lot of that.
Yeah, no, I would agree. That is a good parallel. The other thing it reminded me a little bit of is like a Hulk scene.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's like getting pissed off and trying to hold it back. And you're just like, oh crap. So yeah, he does go nuts. I think, you know, Jod tries to shoot him, but the blaster like jams or doesn't work. And KB and Wim and Fern are all kind of backing up. Fern's trying to get SM-33 to listen to her, but he is not listening to her. He is closing in on the three of them when Neil chucks a rock and hits him square in the head. Everybody kind of stops and is just like, Neil? But we do, you know, I think this is a great moment because, you know, Neil has been struggling with his fear and his, you know, kind of anxiety in the situation here at Akron. but he finds his courage when his friends are in danger. And I think it's, again, a great character moment for Neo, where we see, like, he truly is just, like, such a good-hearted kid. And 33 charges toward Neo. I think still chanting limb from limb. You know, the kids are all shouting. And then Jod does this, like, flying leap and triggers the off switch on SM33, causing him to collapse. He falls on top of Neo, but his arms, like, catch him. Like, his whole body kind of freezes, and he catches himself just above Neo. Neil's, like, kind of, like, lying there stunned for a moment, and the other kid, like, wow, Neo, way to go. And then Neo just faints. And that's pretty much it.
I thought that was a cute part of the episode, Neo just fainting.
Yeah.
The thing. Yeah, I mean, I liked this episode because I thought the introduction to the planet, and I thought the character development we get in, like, the final two scenes between Wim and Fern and with Neo, and SM33 remembering things, like, I liked all of that a lot. I thought it was a very strong beginning and a very strong end to the episode. The only complaint I have is that I felt like it kind of unnecessarily introduced some, like, potentially really dark stuff. That I thought they could have gotten to the same point in the story without digging that hole for themselves. And then instead of there being some, like, you know, interesting thing that whole, you know, instead of them digging down and finding a treasure with that whole, like, child soldier thing, they kind of just, like, hastily filled the hole back in and moved on, which I understand they had to do because it's a kid's show. So I'm not going to knock points for that. The way they handled it is appropriate for the audience that they're aiming for. However, I just feel like, why even introduce that type of dark thing if you're just going to hastily bury it over? Like, you could have gotten the same effect doing something that made a similar amount of sense and, like, didn't dredge up that, like, weird darkness. So for me, that's the only reason I don't like the middle section of the episode, is I felt like their handling of this society, like, wanted to be really dark, and then halfway through they realized, like, actually, we can't do that. We definitely totally can't make it this dark. Like, let's back off of it a bit. And at that point in time, if I was telling the story, I would have been like, hey, let's pivot this a bit to make this society, like, yeah, it's clearly a war-torn society. It's clearly post-apocalyptic, but I think we can handle it a little bit more, you know, nuanced and still achieve the same, hey, General Strix, is he good? Is he bad? Without, like, the bad part of General Strix being, like, insane warlord bad, and the good part being, like, hey, man, he keeps his word. He makes good deals.
Yeah.
You know, so that was the only issue that I had with it. I do this to myself, but I read the IMDb reviews because I'm just curious what people are thinking about the episode. And a lot of it was, like, the episode felt too short. I actually didn't really feel like the episode felt too short. This is maybe the first time where I feel like an episode is kind of, like, ended in the middle of a story instead of it being, like, at the conclusion, right? And in so much as that, like, we haven't left this planet. Mm. Like, they're still on the planet. But I still thought it was a pretty good ending. And honestly, like, although maybe it was the most in the middle of the endings we've gotten so far, I mean, ending with the character development, with SM33, with Neo, it was such a strong ending,
right,
that it didn't really bother me that much. I honestly didn't really find the episode to be too short or to be rushed or anything like that. Like, I thought all the character development was very well earned. I thought it made a lot of sense. Would I have liked to have seen more specifically of what Jod was doing with the Hatan? Probably, but that, I was, like, racking my brain trying to think, is there really anything I needed more of? Like, I didn't actually want to see more of the kids training, because, like, I don't really love the training montage type stuff. So I was actually kind of glad that they, like, glossed over that. And the parts that we did get, I thought were reasonable and fun, right? It showed the competition between Wim and Fern again. You know, it showed Wim getting knocked backwards by a blaster. Like, I thought that was really all we needed out of that.
Yeah.
So I don't really agree with IMDb's, you know, assessment that this needed to be a longer episode. I thought it was pretty reasonable.
Yeah, no, I think this one for me was just the right length. And to me, like, this is, I would say, maybe the first, like, truly cliffhanger ending, mm-hmm. Where we do sort of stop at a dramatic moment in the middle where, you know, there's stuff that's clearly unresolved. But it's also sort of like a mid-season finale. And, you know, we saw the kids feeling at least as if they were in mortal danger and somebody attempting to put them directly into mortal danger. And, you know, we saw a ton of great character growth really pretty much across the board. I think maybe KB is the only one who didn't get a significant amount of character growth in this episode. And she still played an important role in the story. So it's not like we kind of forgot about anybody.
And KB got a lot last episode, too.
We did. She did. We also got a great payoff for SM33 and sort of revealing big part of the mystery that's taking place in Skeleton Crew. Like, it was revealed and explained at the finale of this episode, which was a super exciting final scene. So I feel like if I view it as like a mid-season finale where I'm sort of expecting to get cliffhangered and I want some drama and some excitement, like, I think they nailed that. I think making it longer would not have helped that. I also love that they continue to keep Jod solving problems off screen because it just keeps him that much more mysterious. And I sort of look forward to like having him finally solve some problem on screen and it being like super mundane. You know, like we think he's like, you know, doing some like, you know, like Jedi martial arts or something. And it turns out he literally was telling the truth. He just bribes people and like.
Or runs away.
Yeah. Like there's, you know, there's no heroics whatsoever. It's all a front. So I don't know. I kind of love that they're just like, oh yeah, Jod did a thing. And this is what he's telling you happened. And you know, you can't trust him. So. Enjoy that. Like I love that that's the dynamic that we have. I really, really enjoyed this episode. And I don't think I'm going to give it a 10, but I am going to give it a 9.5. And I recognize that maybe I liked this episode more than some other people like this episode. But I really, really did enjoy the writing through the middle section. And I thought that we got some really complicated characters that I did not expect to see in this show. Much less, you know, the kind of characters that you don't always get in Star Wars to begin with. Outside of like Andor. But in mainline Star Wars, you don't get a lot of like characters where it's like, oh, he's indisputably a villain, but he's also Hana's father and she cares about him. And, you know, he does keep his word. So like he's not like 100% villain. He's just like 95% villain. And you don't always see that. But the 5% is real convincing, right? The last 5% really convinces you to like, almost overlook the fact that he's inarguably evil the rest of the time.
Yeah. I mean, so you give it a 9.5.
I like that kind of characterization.
I think Strix buoyed this episode a lot for you. I think that if I were being generous.
My tastes are not everyone's tastes. I know this.
I would give it an 8.0 because like, I think that the intro to Ad Akron is excellent. I think it's a really, really super well done intro. It piqued my interest. I love the whole thing. I love the mystery of the statue, you know, of what's been happening here.
Yeah.
Loved it. The ending, I think, was excellent. Really loved it. So the beginning and the end, I think, were a 10. I think the bookends of the episode were a 10. I love the development of Fern. You know, I think one of the reviews on IMDb said it felt like it was out of character for Fern because she was so confident. I was like, no, there's been cracks showing in her armor the entire time.
Yeah.
Right. She hasn't been 100% confident this whole time. She literally showed a crack earlier in the episode where she was like, oh, I really don't want to lead us into battle and was trying to back out of that and wasn't able to. Right. So I disagree with that assessment almost entirely. I think because of that, I'll probably give it an 8. You know, the lower side of me wants to give it a 7.5 because I felt like they could have done. I felt like the setting deserved a more interesting payoff than what we got with the Hatan and the Troik. I thought there could have really been a more interesting conflict between those two than like a weird Hatfield and McCoy type situation. And although I don't necessarily need to see those two factions anymore, I do hope we learned what happened to Ad Akron. I'm interested in that mystery.
As am I.
Kind of a lot, actually. Like, I'm really interested in what happened to it. And I hope so. I hope we learn that, even if we don't necessarily see Haina or Strix again. You know,
yeah.
Haina, I actually liked as a character. I thought Haina was pretty good. Unnecessary parkour aside, you know, I thought Haina as a character was pretty fun and a pretty good character. And I liked her interactions with Neil a lot. I think that was another strong point of the episode. Really, the only thing that brought it down for me was just what I found to be an unnecessary introduction of like a super dark topic that is then not entirely, but to not handled to my satisfaction. And again, it's the same thing when you use the dumb kid trope. I just feel like there's better ways to get to where you're going that don't involve you digging yourself a hole and then just like hastily filling it back in. Like I thought there was a better way to do that. And so for me, General Strix being an interesting character aside and being well acted and well performed, which he was, like writing aside, I feel like that has been one of the weaker plot points they've written in a series that so far has been very, very strong in how it has moved the story forward.
Yeah.
And I've even softened a little bit on the dumb kid trope stuff from episode 2, because episodes 3 and 4 have handled Wim so much better that it comes across more as like character growth now looking back on episode 2 than it did initially.
I suspect had they just released the first 4 episodes all at once, you would never have made that complaint.
I almost guarantee I would not have.
You might have mentioned that you briefly worried about that, but then it didn't pan out.
Yeah. And you like know,
at most,
this is what happens when you release weekly episodes. And Skeleton Crew has handled the weekly cadence far better than any of the other recent releases, to its credit. But you can still sometimes see like the chinks in what is otherwise a near flawless armor exposed because of the wait between episodes. Now, that being said, I'm super excited to watch an episode Christmas Eve night on Tuesday. And I assume we won't be talking about it on Christmas Day, which makes sense. But hopefully this week we can do a recording, you know, Thursday night for a Friday morning release. If that's, you know, if you're able to do that, I'm free on my schedule at least.
Boy, you're putting me on the spot here. And I
should have talked about this before the episode, but
I was not prepared to answer that question. More to come on that front. I'll have to see what can be done.
Well, if we have to resolve back to our old, you know, Sunday recording, Monday release schedule like we did this week, then we have to do it. But man, the thing is, I watch the episodes and I'm so excited to talk about it that I have to sit on it for like 5 days afterwards and like wait to chat. So
yeah, well, you know, it does give us time to rewatch it a few times, which is always nice. And you know, had I had more time to rewatch the prior episode before we recorded, I might not have said the things I said. So
that's true.
Where's that?
That is true. The key is you have to watch it twice back to back. Just watch it once and then immediately start it over and watch it again.
I don't think that would have helped that time. Restarting it at midnight would not have been the thing.
Here's the thing. We'll post in Discord what our release schedule is going to look like for the week of Christmas. And once we get it figured out, we'll move on from there. We'll let you guys know.
All right. Well, until next time, may the force be with you.